This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Another busy week in news here. It's time for our Friday news review. FC Cincinnati Stadium moves forward after an agreement is reached with the Cincinnati Ballet, and text messages between Cincinnati City Council members are slated to become public next week. What should we expect to see? We'll discuss that. Plus, a residential development, a huge one in Northern Kentucky, will no longer include apartments. The original plan cost a city's mayor and five members of city council their jobs last November. We explore the reasons for that change. And then more workers are coming to the banks on the Cincinnati riverfront. All that is just ahead. But first, a look at news affecting the state of Ohio, including the governor's proposed gas tax increase and his current position on executions. Joining Cincinnati Edition now are Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, how are you?
And Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Balmer. Welcome, Jesse.
Thanks for having me.
If you have questions or want to weigh in on the topics we explore here today, give us a call, 513-419-7100. You can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll be looking for your comments and your tweets and possibly incorporate some of those into the broadcast today. So Governor Mike DeWine said this week that there won't be any executions in Ohio anytime soon. Let's take a listen to part of what he said.
Ohio is not going to execute someone under my watch when a federal judge has found it to be cruel and unusual punishment.
And Karen, what did the governor mean by that?
Well, there was this federal court ruling that helped determine his decision to delay the execution of Wayne Keith Hennis, which was supposed to happen this month. It was delayed until May 29th. And now he's saying that he's very concerned about that lethal injection protocol, how the lethal drugs are delivered to the inmate and what drugs are actually a part of that. He's concerned about how that stands up to legal scrutiny. So he says he wants to stop all executions until the Department of Rehabilitation and Correction can come up with a new way to do this that will be able to go through the federal court system and get the go-ahead. So given the fact that this takes so much time, I mean, it certainly delays the execution of Hennis from May, and there are 23 execution scheduled between now and 2023. And I think that that really does affect all of those. And potentially, we might not have an execution this year and maybe not even during the DeWine administration. It's going to take a long time for this protocol to be developed, I think.
Yeah. So what does the State Corrections Department have to do exactly? How does one go about finding a new execution drug?
Well, I think that's a problem that a lot of states are looking at because there are some drugs that are limited quantities, some drugs that the drug makers themselves have said that they don't want those drugs used during executions. There's an availability issue. Here in the state of Ohio, there was a law that was passed that would allow pharmacies to try to make these drugs and shield those pharmacies from any sort of public records. But no pharmacies, to my knowledge, have come forward, or at least lawmakers haven't said that they have found pharmacies that have been able to do this. So there's a real problem with availability here, and Ohio is not the only state dealing with this.
So the governor says the death penalty drugs are being ruled as cruel and unusual punishment in the federal court. That's his main factor here influencing that decision to halt the executions in the meantime. Jesse, you wrote that a federal judge compared one of these drugs to waterboarding?
Yeah, essentially the way that Ohio performed the last three executions is a three-drug cocktail, per se. And the first drug, this midazolam, was compared to waterboarding by this U.S. District Court magistrate. And that obviously would fall under cruel and unusual punishment. And so that is one reason why DeWine has decided to halt this until they can find something new. Just availability of drugs has become more difficult as pharmacies, especially those in other countries, have said, we don't want these drugs used for executions and death penalty. So it's left a lot of states in this particular situation.
And I want to add one thing here, too. I think what we've been seeing here in Ohio in the last couple of administrations is some governors who have had some real reservations about the death penalty. Back in November, when Ohio opened up its constitutional exhibit here at the State House, there was a gathering of three former governors, Celeste, Taft, and Strickland. And the three of them talked about the death penalty being one of the most difficult things they had to deal with as governor. And in fact, Strickland said he wished he hadn't allowed any executions, and yet he allowed more executions and had fewer clemency proclamations issued than Governor Kasich, he had more people that he offered clemency to and commuted their sentences from the death penalty to life without parole. I think with Mike DeWine, you have a governor who is a devout Catholic, very religious, identifies as pro-life. I think even though he's a former prosecutor and former attorney general, I think there's a sense that he struggles with this as other governors have struggled with this. And so I think there's something there.
And Karen, I wanted to ask you about that, because I think it was one of your pieces on this topic that wrote that DeWine was a co-sponsor of the state's death penalty law back in 1981. So is that accurate?
He actually voted for the death penalty statute back in 1981, but one of the authors of that statute, Justice Paul Pfeiffer, former Ohio Supreme Court Justice Paul Pfeiffer, has even come out and spoken against the law as it's been applied. There are some real concerns on both sides of this, not just how what drugs are used and how they are how the lethal injection process is done, but also on this side, even before you get to that, how the death penalty process is administered throughout the state, who is actually charged with a death penalty crime and sentenced to death, and who is not. And a lot of times it depends on the county that you're in and whether the county can afford to go through a death penalty trial and this sort of thing. So it's there's been some real concerns raised by Pfeiffer, by Bob Taft, former governor, even by Terry Collins, who was the warden at the Lucasville prison. There are some real questions about the process as well as the drugs that are used.
Reporters at a forum put on by the Associated Press asked DeWine about this earlier this week, and he kind of paused quite a bit, but essentially what he said was it was the law of the state of Ohio, and he's going to let it go at that. He kind of went on to say that we are seeing some problems with the implementation of this, and we know a lot more now than they did in 1981 when he was a co-sponsor on that bill, but, you know, he wasn't going to go as far as to say he doesn't support the death penalty at this point.
So he's not yet giving any indication whether his position, whether it be a previous position or current position, is evolving or changing.
Right. I think it's tough for him because, again, former prosecutor, you know, he just took office a little over a month ago, and he's dealing with a lot of other things that we're going to talk about here. But I think there have been some concerns, like I said, by several governors that the death penalty as a punishment maybe needs to be looked at again. In fact, there was a task force that actually looked into the death penalty in Ohio and made some recommendations. And as far as I know, those recommendations haven't been adopted in any way.
Prosecutors and law enforcement agencies tend to be more supportive of capital cases or at least capital punishment. Has there been any pushback towards the governor from those elements?
No, but I would say even recently, Representative Seitz and a Democratic co-sponsor worked on a bill to basically take people with severe mental illness and exempt them from the death penalty. But even that wasn't getting support in the GOP-controlled state legislature. So even if DeWine has some misgivings on this, I think the legislature, you're not going to see them eager to get rid of this or stall it anytime soon.
Yeah, a lot of the action on this has happened in the court system because, like I said, there's 23 people who are on death row awaiting execution between now and 2023, and the court system has been kind of the delay factor here. I don't think that there's been any movement on the part of the legislature to try to do anything with regard to a moratorium or even there was a period where Ohio was executing people pretty quickly in a sense that there were a lot that came forward that had been into the pipeline and had moved quickly. But then Ohio's been in kind of a bit of a lull. And I think now we're about to not see any executions for quite a while.
So what kind of timeline are we on?
Well, who knows?
Hard to say. So the prison system will have to come up with a new protocol. It seems, you know, almost 99.9% certain that someone would challenge that protocol as unconstitutional under that cruel and unusual punishment. And then that would work its way through the court system, and that can take months or even years. So it's hard to predict.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more.
And so we don't know whether these delays will then force the state to further delay those executions like the planned ones. Are those dates set in stone? Are they going to have to adjust those to test
those are
the
going to be Those are going to be adjusted, absolutely. Okay. In fact, some of them haven't even been officially set. They're just on the calendar. And but yeah, I mean, Jesse's right. Except I would actually raise her number instead of 99.9%. I'd raise it to 100% that it's going to be challenged, because that's what happens. I mean, death penalty, people who are sentenced to the death penalty do have a lot of legal rights in terms of challenging that sentence. And certainly one of the areas that a lot of inmates have used as a challenge is the changing protocol and how the protocol in Ohio hadn't been tried in other states and some of these other things that they've looked at. And so, I mean, certainly unless Ohio goes with a protocol that has been tried in other states, certainly one of the first lawsuits would be, hey, nobody's tried this before, so we're not certain that it won't be cruel and unusual punishment. We're very concerned about that.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to weigh in live. Talk at WVXU.org is our email. Facebook and Twitter available to you as well. We're talking right now with Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kassler and Cincinnati Enquirer government reporter Jesse Ballmer. Some other news related to crime and punishment in the state came out this week. The American Civil Liberties Union pushing for reform after calling the State House a pipeline to prison. Karen, what did that report say?
Well, this is a report that the ACLU has done every couple of years to look back at the previous General Assembly. And this year's report said, hey, when you look at prison overcrowding and spending, you have to lay the blame on that at the feet of state lawmakers who are passing bills that increase penalties and create new crimes. And they said that in this particular report, 1 in 8 bills that the legislature passed either created a new crime or extended sentences. And you know, that's where lawmakers find themselves in kind of a tough spot, because they want to be tough on crime, but then also you have to accept that the people who are in prison, most of them are there for less than a year. Most of them will get out of prison at some point. And how do you make sure that those folks have an opportunity to leave prison and become productive and not return to prison? And so when I spoke to Senate President Larry Obhoff about this the day after that ACLU report, he said that lawmakers have been distinguishing between people who are people who have made mistakes, people who have done things and paid their debt to society, so to speak. And then also the other side of that is people who are truly dangerous, people who are hurting other people and their communities. And there needs to be a line drawn between those two. And that's why they've upped penalties for things like possession of fentanyl, which is a big contributing factor in the opioid crisis. So the ACLU definitely has a different perspective on this than Republican leaders. But there's this whole idea of criminal justice reform really here at the State House, where you have a lot of folks talking about what kind of changes can be made in the criminal justice process. Can there be changes made, for instance, in the sealing of records and in bail that people have to pay to get out of jail? A lot of people who are in jail, especially for minor nonviolent offenses, can't even pay to get out of jail, and they run a lot of economic risks, you know, losing their jobs, that sort of thing. So the criminal justice reform conversation is a big one.
And it's getting some pushback from legislators, I understand.
Well, yeah. I mean, I know that criminal justice reform, for instance, is one of the Senate's top priorities. It's been something that's been talked about. Jesse mentioned Representative Bill Seitz. He's talked about criminal justice reform for years and some things that can be changed. And of course, voters might remember Issue 1 last fall. That was a criminal justice reform issue that got a lot of people on both sides really concerned about the state of the criminal justice system in Ohio. And lawmakers promised, as they opposed Issue 1, that they were going to make some changes. And so we're waiting to see what those changes might be.
Another big story.
And I think this is an interesting backdrop to the conversation that Ohio lawmakers are going to be having about criminal justice reform, especially in the Senate. It's something that they want to tackle. After Issue 1's failure, they are coming up with a variety of ideas, from reducing sentences on drug offenses to, you know, getting more treatment in lieu of conviction, potentially. So there's a lot on the table for that. But it is an interesting backdrop that lawmakers' kind of gut instinct is to add more restrictions and increase penalties.
Jesse, Governor DeWine this week also asked lawmakers to consider an increase in the state gas tax. So what was the deal there?
So Mike DeWine is asking for an 18-cent increase per gallon on the gas tax. Currently, the gas tax is 28 cents. The argument being we haven't increased this in more than a decade, and the state needs money to pay for the roads and fill the potholes and make some new roads that people want to have happen. It would generate about $1.2 billion, I think, each year. And so this is something that he proposed to the lawmakers. Lawmakers now are going to take a look at it and decide if that's the right number, if it needs to be more or less. So we're this kind of the beginning of the process.
Karen, are they finding a public appetite for this tax increase?
Well, I think, gas taxes, I mean, gas prices are something that people talk a lot about, obviously, because you get to see those gas prices as you're driving down the road. So it's a very visible thing. But, I think there's a real concern about how gas taxes haven't gone up since 2003. Back then, it was a 2 cent a year phase in, and 2003 was the last year of that. That's one thing about this 18 cent increase is right now there's no provision to phase that in. It would just start on July 1st. And so there are some questions about whether there's some wiggle room there if lawmakers want to change that and maybe make it kind of a phase in thing. One thing they are doing, though, or at least the bill proposes to do, is index it to inflation, which did not happen in 2003. So, a 6 cent increase back then buys a lot less now than it did in 2003. And so the thought is this time to index the gas price or gas tax increase so that it would rise with inflation. Of course, that means the gas tax rises and your costs do go up. But gas prices aren't like, a price on a jug of milk at the store or a pair of jeans or whatever. They fluctuate based on the commodities markets. So you might not even notice if the gas tax is tacked on because gas prices fluctuate so much. But certainly it is the kind of tax that people who are lower income are going to feel a lot more than people who are upper income, especially people who have cars that are less efficient. They're less likely to drive hybrid vehicles, which use less gas, and of course, electric vehicles that don't use any gas.
We got an email from a listener named Hans. He wondered if anything has been considered in that proposal about electric vehicles.
So in this particular proposal, no, but state lawmakers have been kind of batting about different ideas for that. I know Senator Bill Coley from the Butler County region was keen on putting a fee on electric vehicles or on hybrid vehicles because they don't perhaps they're driving on the same roads, but they aren't paying as much in taxes and so forth. So that's one idea that has been tossed about. The problem is there are just so few electric and hybrid vehicles being used in Ohio right now. It would be a drop in the bucket of the problem that we have as far as paying for.
But there are a lot more fuel-efficient vehicles out on the road,
sure.
And that's having a major impact on this.
And that's contributed to this. I mean, this idea that this is something that was shocking that happened just a couple of weeks ago. The situation at ODOT has been building for years because construction costs have been going up. Inflation has been going up, obviously, and that's driving construction costs up. And we've done these really big projects, these bypasses and whole major fixes for roadways. But at the same time, the gas price or the gas tax had remained flat and you had more fuel-efficient cars. And so all these things mixed together kind of created this storm. And then you added in the leveraging of the Ohio Turnpike, which brought in some money to pay for certain road projects that were close to the Turnpike. That money ran out in 2019. And so here we are in this situation. And, Governor DeWine's getting some heat now because he ran a campaign where he talked about his Democratic opponent, Richard Cordray, wanting to raise taxes. He mentioned it in debates. He mentioned it in ads. Well, now he's the one that's raising the tax. But, DeWine, when he talked about what he was going to do about infrastructure funding, he never ruled out a gas tax increase. He said he would appoint a commission and have them look into it, and they would do it fairly quickly. And that's what's happened. The question is now, I think, is, and we asked him this at the AP forum that Jesse mentioned, when did you know how bad the problems were? And he said he knew during the campaign that ODOT had some issues, but he had no idea how serious they were until actually he became governor. So Richard Cordray had talked about doing an infrastructure bond package that he would have to put before voters. That would have taken a lot more time for the money to come down if voters approved it to fund road repairs. And he even wanted to do public transit and broadband and some other things in that.
I wanted to ask you about Governor DeWine's campaign about making an issue of tax increases and claiming that Richard Cordray, the Democratic opponent, would raise Ohio's taxes. So how are the politics of this proposal playing out in light of that?
Well, I think on the Republican side, it's always hard to raise taxes. A lot of people campaigned on not raising your taxes, and this is a tax increase. So that is challenging. I think it'll be especially challenging in the Ohio Senate, where Senate President Larry Obhoff seems very uncomfortable with a tax hike. As far on the Democratic side, it's a little hard because I think they really want to hit DeWine for this kind of seeming hypocrisy when he was attacking Rich Cordray. But I do think ultimately Democrats, many of them are going to support this increase because of the state of the roads. So they don't want to hit too hard and then have to scramble back later.
And Richard Cordray, I retweeted this yesterday. Richard Cordray actually put out a statement on Twitter saying that first thing out of the box, DeWine, who hit him for wanting to raise taxes during the campaign, first thing out of the box, DeWine is proposing a tax increase, and this is Cordray's words, and he calls it being honest with voters. Well, DeWine has said at that AP forum and in other places that he did want to be honest with voters. That's why he had talked about doing this committee and taking their recommendation. That's exactly what he did. But, you know, I think, like I said, the ODOT situation was something that I think some people saw coming down the road, if you'll pardon the pun. And the question is, how serious was the situation at ODOT? And we found out in the last couple of weeks, it's pretty serious.
Well, campaigns never end anymore. And we do have just about a minute left. And I want to make sure that we touch on this. Sandusky, Ohio, which many of us know here as home to Cedar Point Amusement Park, its city government has voted to make Election Day a holiday. Now, Cincinnati City Council is considering the move as well, which we'll talk about more in the next segment. But what's the reaction been out of Columbus, if anything?
Well, Secretary of State Frank LaRose, he oversees the elections, he said that, you know, anything that's encouraging more people to get to the polls is good. He also said maybe those people could be poll workers now that they have the day off. but he also said, you know, it would only affect city workers. It wouldn't be everyone. And there, he also expressed some concerns that maybe people would just take a four-day holiday if they wanted to kind of leverage the weekend and that Tuesday off and not vote. So I think, in general, people are for having better access to the polls, but I don't think you're going to see a big push from your Republican state officials to, you know, campaign for this across the state.
I want to thank Ohio Public Radio and Television State House News Bureau Chief Karen Kessler and Cincinnati Inquirer government reporter Jesse Ballmert for joining us today. Thanks to you both.
Great to be here.
Thanks.
Up next, the new agreement reached between the Cincinnati Ballet and FC Cincinnati as the soccer stadium moves forward, and what to expect next week when text messages between members of Cincinnati City Council could be released. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Another week of movement for the FC Cincinnati Soccer Stadium and some text messages between city council members will come to light next week. Here to talk about that are WVXU reporter Jay Hanselman. Welcome, Jay.
Out there.
And Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Welcome
Hello.
Back, Chris.
Thank you.
Good to see you. If you all want to weigh in on any of these issues, feel free to give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can also email talk at wvxu.org. Find us on Facebook and Twitter as well. Before we get into those two big items, we were just talking about this in our last segment with the state reporters. So let's continue with Election Day as a holiday. Some members of Cincinnati City Council seem to be inspired by the city of Sandusky's designation. What are we hearing at this point?
So a couple of council members have, well, actually maybe all four of them, I think, are moving towards this direction to introduce some legislation. They want to introduce some legislation that would make Election Day a holiday. Of course, that would only affect city employees because that's the only employees they have control over. And so they're looking at how to do that. You know, questions are how much is it going to cost the city? Can they flip-flop it with another holiday and you know, maybe President's Day or something like that? And make the holiday cost neutral. So, and then there was, of course, some blowback from the Hamilton County Republicans who said this is just another bad idea out of City Hall, and you know, oppose it, saying that there's plenty of time to vote before the election, up to a month, I guess, on early voting, as well as you can mail in your ballot.
I wanted to raise those points so that we emphasize that, because this isn't going to be a holiday like Christmas or the 4th of July where a lot of the community has the day off.
Right. It would just apply. I think their goal is that, you know, that other businesses would follow the city's lead.
Right.
But it would just, you know, be city workers. And just because it's Cincinnati City Council right now, there are two competing proposals. one is a motion. A motion really is an afterthought. It doesn't carry any legislative weight. And basically, that would have the administration study, you know, is this feasible? There is actually also an ordinance that would actually – so basically, that would enact Election Day as a holiday, and they would ask the city workers to give up President's Day, and then in exchange, they would get Election Day as a holiday.
So Sandusky swapped Columbus Day with Election Day.
And they can't do that in Cincinnati because most of the bargaining units have given up. They work Columbus Day in exchange for the day after Thanksgiving.
Oh, you're talking about the union.
So yeah. Right.
Okay. Well, how interesting. All very complicated. So nothing's easy.
And now there was some talk that they – I would think it would be very – they can, but to add it as an 11th holiday would come with a price tag. So I think that they're going to have to either – they'll have to swap it out for one of the other holidays, or otherwise it would come with a price tag.
We'll look forward to that.
Maybe they make it a floating holiday or something like that.
Excuse me. It's been another week of FC Cincinnati Stadium news. And Jay, you wrote the story that the stadium cleared construction hurdles.
It needed to for them to actually bring the stadium out of the ground, which they call vertical construction. They needed to approve a zoning change. And it's not really as much as a zoning change as it is a planned development. So they had to approve the here's the footprint. It won't exceed this footprint. And here's an initial design of what the stadium would look like. And that's what council did this week. They approved that yesterday after a week delay to work on trying to get agreements with the Cincinnati Ballet and Monica Williams, who had the Just Cook and Catering business. They got those worked out, and council voted unanimously to approve the plan development. And so now they have the approval that they need, minus final approval of the design from the City Planning Commission.
Okay, so there is another step before
there is
the
another step,
city officials.
As far as I know, this is council's last chance to weigh in. It will have to go back to the Planning Commission, but that's almost as long as they don't exceed the footprint or the stadium's not bigger than what they propose, that should just be a sign-off.
Oh, so the city staff may be able to approve this with approve the design without
the planning
any vote.
There would be five members of the Planning Commission.
It would go to a commission. Okay.
Vote on.
One thing that is left over from a public standpoint is the county garages. The county, of course, passed a resolution to kind of clear the way for Major League Soccer to give FC Cincinnati its franchise. Said they're going to build 1,000 parking spaces. There's a report out about where those spaces should be. The county, I think, is moving towards having two different sites, one kind of close to Findlay Market, one on the stadium site itself. That has caused heartburn amongst FC Cincinnati executives who would like all of that parking at the site itself.
And the preliminary design, I think, of the one garage that was on the site is actually on the site where the Cincinnati Ballet is located now. So if they're going to be a good neighbor to the Cincinnati Ballet, I don't think they would be building a parking garage on top of their building.
Yes. And so I want to dive into a couple of those issues. And Jay, you mentioned them before. So is the Ballet happy now, and are they going to stay happy?
They're happy-ish is the best way to put it, I think. They have an agreement that they think will work for them for the next 17 years. I think there's also kind of a dual track thing where they will explore leaving that site for the next until April. I think they'll try to negotiate that with FC Cincinnati, and there's some incentives for them to do so. They get $1 million that's earmarked right now for sound mitigation. They can take that and use it at their potential new site someday. And then there's about almost $500,000 in rent forgiveness for a 2-year period where they're in the process of moving, if that actually happened.
And I was going to say, I mean, we heard numbers tossed around. I think Chris and I were talking about this at the council meeting yesterday, you know, that there were numbers floating around City Hall that FC Cincinnati had asked the Ballet, what will it take for you to leave? And the number was, well, $11 million. And then I think the middle part of last week, I heard $5.5 million. So now the number that's in the actual document is $1 million.
Right. Right. And, you know, I think this all kind of remains to be seen. With the parking garage, FC still plans to demolish the Tri-State Wholesale Building Supply building, which is kind of attached in a way to the Ballet building. The provisions in the agreement call for some safeguards there. And if they have to, for example, take a shared elevator out, they're going to have to put it back for the Ballet to use. And then, you know, I think that's the Tri-State Wholesale building, which is something FC bought for $25 million. That's where they think they want to put that garage. So,
and I think, you know, they've got the till April the 1st to try to negotiate on relocating. And my guess is I think they were working on that. It was just becoming harder and harder to put together by a deadline to have the vote yesterday. So that if it's possible that they've got a little more time to talk to check some of these things out, that while there is this agreement, it wouldn't surprise me that, you know, maybe by April 1st or sometime in the spring, there is a plan that the Ballet will relocate, which I think they had initially indicated that they were out of space. They wanted to move anyway. And so this might.
Right. I think the details were difficult to get together. And I think there was obviously a lot of emotions, people very worked up over this. And so it wasn't something that could get done in the week that was going on there. One thing to say about the Ballet is that they've got, people think, well, you know, that's the Ballet. They've got a couple, you know, they've got these performances, but they have this whole other academy now where they're basically serving young people. And that's a growing part of their business. And they need their current building to kind of stay in place for that business to, you know, thrive. So, you know, that's kind of some of the issues there.
Athletes and artists can coexist.
They can.
And Chris, I was going off the top of my head, but it seemed to me that the Ballet's Good Neighbor Agreement was a whole lot more detailed.
It sure was.
Than the Good Neighbor Agreement with Music Hall.
It sure was. You know, I don't, you know, I think the Ballet drove kind of a harder bargain, and that obviously irritated the team a little bit. And I think that's probably, you know, why you're going to see some negotiations continue between the two of them.
One thing that we didn't, that we said that it's almost over for city council. One thing that is still out there is the idea of whether Central Parkway can be closed during game days. And five council members had signed a motion saying they object to Central Parkway being closed. That was referenced in the Ballet's agreement too. So that will be something that we'll probably come back with a report from the city administration on probably the pros and cons of that, and then that could be something that council has to yet weigh in.
Well, I don't know, Jay. I mean, would one of the pros be that we'd get an extra day off and we wouldn't be able to get here to the station, would we?
I would think they would tell us that there are other ways to find our parking garage.
Take the bus.
We may not be able to park in our parking garage on game days.
513-419-7100 if you want to weigh in. Talk at WVXU.org, Facebook, and Twitter as well. So there's also the ongoing issue about Just Cook and Catering over there. This also seemed to get resolved. This business is owned by Monica Williams. She had lost her lease when the stadium site was purchased, but there appears to be some resolution here. What was that discussion?
So basically what happened was the city agreed to kick in $75,000 from a weather reserve fund. I don't remember what that's...
It's a contingency fund for weather emergencies.
Right. Whatever that is, that's where it came from. And the team gave about $175,000, and the Port Authority is going to provide a food truck for her to operate over the next couple of years. This money that she got is going to go into an escrow account while she develops a business plan for her new restaurant. Her old restaurant, of course, was demolished, or the space where it was demolished. And so they'll look for a new spot for her and try to figure that out. I know that she does want to be in the West End where her customer base was, and this food truck will help her get those customers, but also capture some of the construction workers, many of whom are going to obviously work on the FC Stadium project.
Did she seem happy about this?
I didn't see her personally yesterday. I think that
a couple of her supporters were
happy,
but she didn't actually. I think she addressed council last week, but as far as I know, she didn't talk this week.
Monica Williams is working the third shift at Kroger after she lost her business, so she might have been asleep actually when this vote happened.
Yeah. And that was part of the idea with the food truck is let's get her back in business as quick as possible, which that should happen, and then that gives her some time to come up with, like Chris said, a business plan and a location to use the funds that'll be in an account when she chooses to do so.
Yeah.
And some old businesses sort of resurfaced in the debate this week at City Hall. I heard the mayor reference the Masonette one of the retail institutions downtown.
We're going to go down that rabbit hole, huh?
Let's do it. Yeah, because it shows the discomfort that sometimes, I guess, depending on who happens to be at City Hall, about investing in some of the smaller private enterprises.
Well, the mayor has a philosophical objection to investing in retail and restaurants, even in a case where, you know, he and the majority of council approved a development that displaced this lady. And, you know, they played a major role in it. And that's why Councilman Sittenfeld and Councilman Landsman decided that the city needed to really get into it, even though, yeah, I think, you know, retail and restaurants, pretty risky investment for city government to make. But she was already operating a successful restaurant there for the most part. And that's why they felt that they had to act. Amy Murray felt similarly. I think, you know, they said, well, you know, look, FC or the landlord that had, you know, that had sold the building to FC, they should have taken care of this. And maybe they should have, but council never used its leverage last year when it was voting on this initial package of city aid to force that to happen. So, you know, basically council kind of cleaning up after itself.
So the last things we have to worry about then with the stadium for now, Central Parkway, the design has to come before a commission inside the building. And then we've got some garage issues.
Right, right. The county has to resolve the garages.
And I think Councilmember Sittenfeld told us both after the meeting, you know, we've heard a lot about being a good neighbor. And while there can be good neighbor agreements, you have to actually abide by those good neighbor agreements and be a good neighbor. And it's like he said, if anything and along the way, if somebody becomes a bad neighbor, those issues are probably going to come back to city council. So while the votes may be over, if there's problems down the road, it will probably wind up at 801 Plum Street on the third floor in the council chamber.
All right, let's talk about text messages. I don't really know the backstory. Maybe some of our listeners don't know the backstory of the so-called Gang of Five, but give us the brief Cliff's Notes before we dive into what's happening next. Just a little recap.
I'll start and Chris can finish.
Okay. That's fine with me.
Last spring, Mayor John Cranley had asked then city manager Harry Black to either resign or be fired. And five council members objected to that. And they were discussing their objections in a series of text messages between what became known as the Gang of Five.
Who gave them that moniker?
Actually, it was Wendell Young, I think.
He said one time, "We are a Gang of Five,"
and it stuck.
Oh, okay. And certain people have decided that they all call themselves that when that's not really true. But anyway, go ahead.
And so they were sharing text messages back and forth, and a local activist thought that was a violation of the Ohio open meetings law, because when you have five, you have a council majority. And he filed a lawsuit. And as part of that, he asked for discovery of all the text messages between not just beyond the conversation with Harry Black, but the five had conversations about other things. And then he went so far that he wanted conversations between two, three, and four council members. So that was basically any text messages sent or received among the Gang of Five, it was just one of them or all five of them.
Okay, so now we may get our hands as members of the media on all of these messages as well. What do we expect to see in them?
Well, with the judges, with the settlement apparently, and it's going to be unveiled in court on March 7th, but apparently they will hand over these text messages to this attorney whose name is Brian Shrive. And, you know, it'll be up to either the council or Shrive to determine what gets released, right? I think there's probably a question of, once they compile these, you know, are they public record? Given that the city has compiled them, that was a question of an appellate court case actually too that Shrive has filed. There's actually two cases here.
And I think the settlement though dismisses that case though. So we really
I saw that, but
that.
No one said that to me. I would assume that's correct, but I don't actually know. So it's kind of all swirling around. We'll see what we see, but I think there's a lot of belief that we will see these text messages, and so we'll see what's in them.
So in our last minute here, is anybody nervous about this release? Has anybody expressed any?
I've heard everything. But oh my gosh, you're not going to believe this. I've heard, you know, this is much ado about nothing. Yeah, there will probably be a couple of bombshell texts. So it runs the gamut. It's like, I can't believe that we're reading this stuff. And now it's just no big deal.
You know, think about what you might text your friends or your coworkers and think about whether you'd want some of that stuff to be out. And I think that's probably kind of the same situation.
Yeah, the answer is no. So I guess we'll all look forward to next week, and that'll be fun.
Not next week, March 7th. Oh, week after
the week after. Gotcha. Okay. So thank you, Jay Hanselman, for that little clarification and for being on the show as well. Thank you, Chris Wedderk, for coming back as well. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Sanctuary Village is a forthcoming mixed-use development in Villa Hills, but earlier plans for it cost the mayor and five members of council their jobs last November, and now the project appears to be scaling back some, and a bunch more workers are coming to the banks on the Cincinnati riverfront. So here to discuss is Cincinnati Business Courier reporter Tom Demiropoulos. Welcome, Tom.
Great to be here.
And it's 513-419-7100 if you have a question for us, or talk at wvxu.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter as well. Let's start with the situation in Villa Hills, because this is a massive development led by Edgewood-based Ashley Builders. It's been kind of tied up in court because a residential group formed because they oppose some elements of it. So what's new?
That's right. So the development team here has had approval from City Council back in March of 2018 for their grand vision for about 85 acres of property there in Villa Hills that was owned by the monastery. And they initially had called for plans for 187 apartment units in kind of the core of this mixed-use project with commercial and then single-family homes around it. Well, the residents didn't like that level of density and that number of apartment units, so the developers have eliminated the apartments and then also reduced the density of the homes on the property as well.
And this is land, we call it the monastery, it's St. Walburg Monastery, but it's actually where the Benedictine sisters reside.
Yes.
And they have tried to sell this property to fund their retirement. And now what we're noticing in the development is the apartment building's gone. And for the first time, we understand now that some prominent Northern Kentucky home builders are also involved in constructing some of the single family homes.
Yeah, so this is big, as the two kind of big hometown home builders, Dries Homes and Fisher Homes, are going to be the single family home builders in the development, along with Ashley Builders, who will be building some of the single-family homes. Ashley also will be building, they're going to have what they're calling kind of ranch-style cottage homes and then townhomes. And those will both be kind of those new urbanist with the alley loading garages. So they'll feel more like a streetscape, like an old-time streetscape where you have the big front porch and the tree-lined street. So that's what they're going for with that look.
Have you seen any analysis, or have you crunched any numbers yourself on what impact the loss of that apartment building may have been on Ashley, and then the introduction of these home builders? Does that help offset that in some way?
I haven't seen a breakdown of that, but reducing density is probably going to hurt a little bit in terms of the amount of money that can get. But at the end of the day, I think it was more about putting together a project that made sense for the developer, for the sisters, and for the community.
And it's interesting that this settlement was reached, because this was in court. This was in Kenton County Circuit Court. The settlement was reached with the opposition and the developers. And it seemed that the law may have ended up being on the developer's side. So does this appear to be just some good neighborly relationship building?
I think so. I think it just makes the most sense from the developer's side. I mean, this is a longtime Northern Kentucky company. They want to be a good neighbor. They want to put together a development that is going to have goodwill from the residents and from the new residents that want to move into this area and from the existing surrounding residents.
All right, let's talk about General Electric, because we had some pretty cool news this week. All right. You have a headline in the Business Courier this week: GE still committed to downtown Cincinnati. Why was there ever doubt?
Well, I don't know if there was a doubt, but it was the fact that they haven't reached the job numbers that they had initially projected for the Global Operations Center at the banks. So when this project was announced, it was kind of a minimum of 1,400 jobs, and they were thinking it could be grow to 1,800 jobs and potentially 2,000 jobs. So the numbers haven't gotten to there really quite yet. They reported 1,441 jobs in 2017, and currently GE officials say they're closer to about 1,300 employees down at the banks. So the news this week was that GE Aviation, which is the subsidiary of GE that handles their jet engine and all the businesses that are related to that, they're going to be moving what they're calling several hundred employees down to the banks.
Where are they coming from?
So they'll be coming from leased space in and around Evendale, which is the headquarters for GE Aviation. And these are going to be office employees that are coming. They're both internal IT operations and then part of the GE Aviation's digital solutions team, which works with data and analytics to help their customers, you know, improve their business operations.
So there are a couple of different GE components to this then. There's the initial 1,400 jobs that were suggested, but these are in addition to that?
Yes. So these are jobs that are not related to the global operations center that's currently down at the banks, but it's still kind of to be determined in terms of like the city's incentive that was given to GE for moving down to the banks. They gave a job creation tax credit back in 2014 when this project was announced. So the city is still working to verify if these jobs, because they will be new jobs to the city of Cincinnati, if they would still qualify for that tax credit.
When you talk to GE officials, what is it that they like about that area?
So one of the things that kept coming up with GE was that they love the building. And having walked through the space, it is great for collaboration. And that's the type of teams that they're bringing down to the banks from GE Aviation, is teams that are going to work together in teams, kind of break into groups and work on different projects to solve different problems. But then they can also go back to their own space and kind of work on what they need to, in addition to being able to quickly group, gather together, hammer out a problem and get back to work individually.
So will the original GE proposal and the aviation folks, will they all be in that building then?
Yes. So Okay. Right now they're still trying to work out kind of the seating logistics of adding hundreds of employees to the existing building, but they're working through that process now.
There might be room on the Ferris wheel, I suppose. How does it relate to the overall importance of the success of the banks?
This is huge for the banks. Having that building full of office employees drives traffic to the retailers. It drives traffic to the restaurants, to coffee shops. It's a big deal for Cincinnati, for that area to be lively 24/7 or as close to 24/7 as possible. So having that building full up, and even the additional parking revenue that comes from more employees parking down at the banks, it's just a benefit for that region.
Have you heard from county officials on their reaction to this influx of people?
I have not yet. I've not heard from the county.
Yeah,
about this.
I would imagine that they share your sentiment, though, that this has to be something that's quite important. And then the parking situation is often one that's cited as concern for people when they come downtown. Is this going to be advantageous for the company to be located here? Is it going to be disadvantageous for visitors?
So according to GE officials, what they've said is they've worked on a reduced rate for their employees that will be moving down there, because they're obviously moving from Evendale, where they probably had free parking. So they're going to offset some of that cost for their employees. But I don't think there should be any concern about too many spaces going to employees. That's a huge garage down there at the banks. Should be plenty of room.
The last line in this article from I guess last week or earlier this week is that GE had been struggling and looking for ways to cut costs in its headquarters town of Boston. It said last week that it would not build and occupy a 12-story office there. That's according to your sister paper in Boston. And will instead pay back $87 million in incentives. But that's not happening here.
That's not been the case here. Here in Cincinnati, the incentives have been performance-based, which is, I think, a very smart move for the city of Cincinnati and the state of Ohio to make everything based on performance. So GE hasn't taken any incentives that they haven't earned, and they're kind of retroactive. So in terms of their 2018 incentives, they won't apply for they're sending in their information for that before the end of this month, and then they'll get their incentive based on the jobs that they created in 2018 later this year.
And they have such a long history in the region with the Evendale site and all that. So do you think that plays a role in?
Absolutely. They're a huge employer, vastly important to the region, just a big part of Cincinnati's history.
What's coming next at the banks? You got any scoop for us?
Nothing new that I know of outside of that. Waiting to see what happens with the music venue, waiting to see what happens with the phase 3 block. There's kind of a proposal sitting out there that's been out for, gosh, going on about 9 months now. So hopefully we can see some movement this year.
Cool. Tom DeMaropoulos from the Business Courier, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Archives of our program are online at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.